Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway on this Tuesday morning. And very pleased to welcome two new affiliates to the Hugh Hewitt Show universe, WZOE AM 1490 in the Illinois Valley, WLMD FM 104.7 in Western Illinois. That will bring me about as close to the Chicago Convention this summer as I want to be. But to the good people at WZOE AM 1490 and to WLMD FM 104.7, I want to thank you for joining the universe and the Hugh Hewitt Borg. The Borg, gotcha.
We are the Borg. Lower your shields and surrender your ships. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt.
You have joined my ecosystem, and I welcome you. I've been doing this for 24 years, about to celebrate our 24th anniversary on July 10th of the launch of the nationally syndicated show. I'll give you the bio in June on the first broadcast day, but let me tell you this. This is why you listen. I'm a news-driven show. I'm a center-right guy. A lot of people call me an establishment Republican. I'm a Reagan Republican. But the truth of the fact is that I will give you objectively what is going on in the world. Last night in D.C., I had dinner with either two cabinet members in the next Trump administration or a vice president and a cabinet member in the next Trump administration, by my guess, and their staffs. And we had a great time. But it's off the record, 3 hours, and I can't tell you a thing about it other than it happened. And my reporting of everything is informed by spending my day like that. And I do that when I'm in the Beltway. Now, I'm fleeing the Beltway at the end of the week and going north for a few, at least 4 months, because no one should be in the Beltway during a political campaign season because no one's here and there's no news here and I can talk to everyone on the phone. But let me begin with the key news. Israel has moved on Rafah. They've taken over the Rafah crossing. I'm going to read you the headlines and then double back with some analysis. Wall Street Journal. Israeli forces seize key Gaza crossing ahead of planned Rafah offensive. Financial Times. Israel sends troops into Rafah. The Telegraph of Great Britain. Israeli tanks capture Rafah border crossing. The Times of Israel. Israeli tanks said to roll into Rafah after war cabinet okays offensive. Of course, we pay a lot of attention to the Times of Israel in this program covering the Israel-Gaza war because they actually know what's going on. Wall Street Journal again. U.S.-Israel rift widens over Rafah assault. Within this reporting, confirmed elsewhere, is that the United States has suspended deliveries of precision munitions to Israel. That makes no sense, but I'll come back to that. I guess they want Israel to use dumb bombs or dumber bombs, not precision strikes. From Axios, one of the little insider letters based on being stenographers to power, Barik Ravid, and no big fan, John Podhoretz is no big fan of Barik Ravid. I do not know him. Israeli frustrated with U.S. handling of the hostage talks. This reporting is very, very detrimental to Team Biden, who apparently negotiated a separate deal without Israel there. Hamas said they accepted because, of course, it included an end to the war. You know, and Israel said, no, we didn't agree to that. Then the key headline, maybe you didn't notice this, the IDF announces two reserve troops killed in a Hezbollah drone attack on Monday. The Israelis lost four IDF soldiers and 10 more seriously wounded on Sunday. They lost two soldiers on Monday. The four Israeli soldiers were at a crossing the United States obliged Israel to open into Gaza in the south. The two that were killed yesterday were killed by Hezbollah in the north. The war against Israel goes on, but the Washington Post has this headline. For Biden, a tough call looms on whether Israel violated laws in Gaza. That's absurd. That's stupid. That's political. That's like Barack Obama, Ben Rose, upside down, the sky is green sort of stuff. Israel has conducted the most civilized war. War is always savage. War always has civilian casualties. But they have been the most careful military in world history. And the idea that we have violated laws in Gaza and it's being debated, trial balloon intended to intimidate the Israelis, and they're going to say, screw you. I'll come to that in a bit. Inside, the White House scrambled to broker a deal in Gaza. Peter Baker, good reporter. You can trust him. Doesn't matter what's going on inside of the White House. Israel is at war. Israel is getting killed. Its soldiers are on the front line. It is not up to the United States. The Israelis are not in a protectorate run by the United States, no matter what Tony Blinken thinks and Joe Biden mumbles. The Times of Israel confirmed the Wall Street Journal reporting U.S. said delaying delivery of precision bombs to Israel. Then we have an update from the campuses. Here are the latest developments on campuses. This is from the New York Times. Galvanized by an Israeli military incursion to Gaza's southern end. Anyone believe that? Really? That's really stupid. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators, they ought to be called pro-Hamas demonstrators, escalated campus protests. At Rhode Island School of Design, does that qualify as a campus? I know it's good at design, but it's not really a campus. Singled out the threat of an imminent ground invasion as their All Eyes on Rafah rally occupied the students' main administrative building on Monday evening. Okay, hire no one from the Rhode Island School of Design. Add them to the list, and the list is getting long. Universities that are crazy, universities that are coward, add. If you hired people from the Rhode Island School of Design, don't do it now. UCLA arrested another 44 demonstrators with the help of LAPD. Good. Meanwhile, protests are scheduled today at UC Berkeley, Cal State University Los Angeles, UCLA, and the University of Washington. It's the old Pac-10. We shouldn't have let any of them into the Big Ten. Tensions were rising at the MIT again. Nobody really cares about these people. Really, they don't. It's organized. It's going to be a long, hot summer. My new affiliates, WZOE AM 1490. You know, this is the La Salle, Peru area. It's about 100 miles from downtown Chicago, WRMD-FM. You might be White Sox fans. I feel sorry for you. You might be Cubs fans. I'm still bitter over 2016. Don't go to Chicago. I have a clip I play here, which might be handy. It comes from the movie, it's not Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. It's the other Guy Ritchie movie. Got anything to declare? It's Uncle Avi.
Anything to declare?
Yeah, don't go to England.
Here's what I've got to declare. Don't go to Chicago. Now, I'm not going to Chicago or Milwaukee this year. I'm done with conventions. I started in 2000. I've been in 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016, 2020. I'm not going this year. You know why? Turns out the 2020 campaign and the 2016 campaigns were the first time I'd done conventions in the 6 to 9 a.m. time slot, East Coast time, first time I'd ever done it. And we're taped late in a lot of places, but there's nobody there. There's nobody to talk to from 6 to 9 in the morning. So I talked to Phil Boyce, who is the boss of all of the talk shows at Salem Syndicates. And I said, clear it with everybody. I think this is a waste of money. I do better reporting inside the Beltway, talking to people all night long and staying up late, rather than going to parties at the RNC. I like the RNC parties. It's a wonderful thing, but I'm not going to that. But I'm here to tell you, last night is example. To my new affiliates, I actually know what I'm talking about, and I encourage you to listen every day. I have a podcast version of the show, Highly Concentrated Hue, which takes probably a third of the content and makes it available every day at iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get podcasts. I would appreciate it if everyone listening rated it, followed it, told their friends about it, and then decide, oh, I'm going to join the universe instead. Because at the Huniverse, which is a subscription service, you get every minute of every show commercial-free. You get every minute of every show back to July 10 of 2000. You also get a podcast by me and three or four podcasts a week, either by Dwayne or by me. Dwayne is my senior producer. He is the goes by many names, Generalissimo. My nickname is Wave Master with my California roots. But Generalissimo was so named because he simply is a dictator who I don't listen to much, but he shows up. We have many sponsors on the show. You'll hear me talk about them. One of them is myphdweightloss.com. And Harley, I want this included today in the highly concentrated you. I'm introducing a couple of new affiliates to sponsors. Under FCC rules, if you have a sponsor and you mention them on the air, you have to mention the fact that they're a sponsor. So when I bring up my PhD weight loss, 864-644-1900, 864-644-1900, I have to say they're a sponsor. And occasionally I will then go over and I'm going to show you a picture. If you're watching on the Salem News Channel, my new affiliates, Over the Top, they call it. You can find it all over the world. And you can find it on your app. You'll see Dwayne's big, shiny, bald head. And there's Dwayne right now. And he's looking up. He's very skinny. He's 50 pounds lighter than he was when we began this show. And now he put his head down in shame. He shouldn't be ashamed. He couldn't pitch when he was 50 pounds heavier. If he had been able to pitch, he might have had a longer career. But now he's down to being skinny. He's got a scooter that he goes out on. And you'll hear a lot about Dwayne and Adam and Harley and Ben and Phil and everybody else in my radio family as we go along. But mostly, I do the news. And the news today is Israel has lost its ally and its support of the United States because Joe Biden has lost the threat. Stay tuned. What I feel about Joe Biden and Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, I can't say on the radio. They're trying to have Israel lose this war. I go back to the Wall Street Journal stories I mentioned in passing in the first segment. From the Israeli forces seeking Gaza City crossing come these paragraphs. 20 militants were killed, 3 tunnel shafts were discovered, and special forces are continuing to scan the area, according to the Israeli military. An explosive-laden car driving towards Israeli troops was struck. No Israeli soldiers were injured, according to the IDF. Israel has long been concerned that the border area with Egypt has been a route for smuggling weapons and people into Gaza and is a critical element of Hamas's military supply chain. Israel has pressed for tighter controls in the, quote, Philadelphia corridor, which runs the length of the southern border, a move that could raise issues with a 1979 peace treaty between Israel and Egypt that limits troop presence on both sides. That is why Israel is going to do this inside of Gaza, and they're going to knock everything down, and I hope they make it a mile wide, and just dig a moat and fill up those tunnels and do not allow Gaza to rearm this way. The corridor is much more important than 4 battalions of Hamas that you have in Rafah. They actually have about 20,000 fighters, said Ofar Shailah, a military analyst with the Tel Aviv-based Institute for National Security Study. Hamas has been resupplying itself and reinforcing itself mainly from the Sinai Desert. So you understand, we're not going to put up with another Vietnam where North Vietnam sends weapons and troops and supplies and critical munitions from the north into the south along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. None of that. Israel is going to dig, and they're going to cut it off, and it's going to stop. From the second part of this, why is Joe Biden trying to make Israel lose? Second story. The U.S. This is a direct quote of Matthew Miller at the State Department. The U.S. will not support the Rafah offensive currently envisioned by Israel. Such an offensive would dramatically increase the suffering of the Palestinian people. First of all, 2 lies. The U.S. does support the Israeli offensive, the larger U.S., not the Biden administration, which has swung wildly against Israel, then in favor of it, then against it, then in favor of it, now against it. The United States has not. 70% approval for Israel in the United States and rising within the Republican Party and the future President Donald Trump. He was and will be again a strong supporter of Israel. Wouldn't be bad if he sent Mike Pompeo, if he's not the vice president, to be Secretary of Defense, so none of this shenanigans goes over at DOD. Wouldn't be bad if he sent David Friedman back to Israel, best ambassador we've ever had there. Also from the Wall Street Journal yesterday, or this morning, with the two sides at odds, U.S. and Israel, at odds over the potential Rafah operation, the Biden administration has delayed the sale of thousands of precision weapons to Israel, marking at least the second time in recent months the U.S. has held up an arms deal to its closest Mideast ally in the war on Gaza. The move affects up to 6,500 joint direct attack munitions, kits that enable unguided bombs to be directed at a target using satellite guidance. For the life of me, I do not understand how Team Biden decides the one thing they're not going to send to Israel are the precision munitions that make it harder to kill civilians. It's like, but they haven't done this, but it is as though they had adopted the Hamas strategy of obliging Israel to kill civilians by denying them precision munitions. Israel is not going to stop now. Benny Gantz said that. Now, he is the centrist, member of the war cabinet. He said, we're going in and they are going to go in. Why does Joe Biden want Israel to lose this war? Why does he want 20,000 armed terrorists left there? I don't know. You don't know. All right. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway Live this morning. To my new affiliates in the Illinois Valley and in the area of La Salle in Peru, I've got two great new affiliates, and I greatly appreciate it when the station manager reposes confidence in us, and I try and pay attention and educate the audience for a little bit. It's WZOE AM 1490 in the Illinois Valley, WLMD FM 104.7 in Western Illinois. I try and pay very close attention to you. But I can't do the bio on me entirely, but you should know I've written 14 books. I write two columns a week for Fox News. I'm a contributing columnist to the Washington Post, which is as moved and as needed. Longer process for the Post, shorter process for the Fox News folks. And yesterday I became convinced that the United States has laid down its leadership mantle. So my new Fox News column this morning is simply titled, Which Nation Leads the West? And I'm going to ask you to indulge me. I want to read it. So those of you who can't get to Fox News, very easy to Google these columns. Just Google Fox News and Hugh Hewitt and every column I've ever written for them. And I started this year in January. And I do, yeah, it's piling up. But they always put the most recent one on top. And Which Nation Leads the West is on top. Which nation is the leader of the West? To answer that question, you must first define what the West is. There are 100 different definitions, and indeed an entire PBS series devoted to that question. Civilization, the West and the Rest with Neil Ferguson, great historian, debuted in 2012, and the accomplished historian issued a companion book at the same time and with the same title. In Civilization, the West and the Rest, the summary of the book in Amazon relays, best-selling author Neil Ferguson argues that beginning in the 15th century, the West developed six powerful new concepts that the rest lacked. Competition, science, the rule of law, consumerism, modern medicine, and the work ethic. Those characteristics are fine, I write, easily applied to exclude from the West tyrannies such as the People's Republic of China, Russia, Iran, and all of their puppet states or proxies. But it does not include the essential ingredient of the West, freedom. The West is defined by this essential must-have feature, some significant measure of individual liberty. The liberty must include the rule of law, not the rule of despots or oligarchs. There's no rule of law where the law can be easily manipulated or avoided. There cannot be in any member nation of the West a secret police that operates without restraint and oversight, but solely on the direction of an unaccountable despot or despots. The members of the West have free elections at regular intervals and guaranteed freedom of conscience, speech, and almost always movement within their boundaries to their citizen. Constitutions of member states may be written, as in the United States, or unwritten, as in the United Kingdom. Nations in the West may be large or small, rich or poor, and since the end of World War II at least, can be found on every continent. Countries can be part of the West and then lose that status, as happened to Venezuela. Or it can aspire to and eventually join or rejoin the West, as happened with many former members of the now-defunct Warsaw Pact. Poland is one such country, as are many others surrounding Ukraine. Ukraine aspires to be part of the West, and it's fighting and its people suffering and many thousands dying to keep that dream alive. Japan was a tyranny and an empire, but defeated by the Allies in 1945, it is now among the West's leaders. Even as the definition becomes clearer, the first question I pose becomes more and more difficult to answer. Which nation leads the West? Until December 7, 1941, the leader of the West was the United Kingdom, standing alone after the defeat of France by Hitler's Germany in 1940. After Pearl Harbor, the United States was thrust into the role of leader of the West and remained there without question until this decade, until very recently, in fact. Now there are reasons to doubt that leadership, for the United States has failed to fulfill that role since 10-7, slipping again and again into a catastrophic ambiguity about the nature of the alliance of the West, and at times throwing into considerable doubt whether we, the United States, can be relied upon as an ally and as an enemy of tyrants and maniacs. A similar palsy overtook us in the aftermath of our loss of the Vietnam War during the presidency of Jimmy Carter. President Ronald Reagan cured and restored us. That palsy that marked the late 1970s in the United States has now returned. The U.S. remains by far the wealthiest and strongest nation in the world, but is at present divided at home and deeply confused about good and evil, friend and enemy. President Biden, already infirm and increasingly incoherent, seems to be headed towards incapacity, but he is, by operation of the Constitution, the commander-in-chief of our supremely strong military. We cannot know what he is like in private, and many Americans suspect he's not in full control of the executive branch. Certainly many suspect that among our allies and are concerned about his, quote, leadership. President Biden's infirmity and growing incoherence has indeed caused the whole world to wonder if anyone is in charge of the country. Of course, few will say this out loud. America's power to punish is still robust, even if the president isn't. So our allies pretend that all is fine, while our enemies plot and plan. But since the collapse in Afghanistan signaled to the world that the United States was run by a band of weak bumblers, headed in title and not, if not in fact, by a very old man of limited ability, it is hard to argue that the United States is leading anything at all these days. If the West, as understood as the family of nations committed to everything laid out above, has any leader at all right now, it seems like Israel is the only candidate qualified to step up into the vacuum left by the United States, paralyzed by its weakness of leadership. But Israel is also under siege on the world stage and at war with ruthless enemies. And the United States is of a divided mind about Israel, with the left wing of the Democratic Party apparently afraid that Israel might actually win and destroy the military capabilities of Hamas, and perhaps after that, Hezbollah. If the United States cannot proudly stand with Israel on the side of victory by Israel over an evil terrorist puppet of an evil theocracy, Iran, then we have to, at least for a season, give up the title of leadership of the West. Israel is the unlikeliest of all nations to become the most courageous defender of the West's highest and best traditions, but there it is. Alone and besieged, with weak-kneed allies and an absurd world media elite that has lost any idea of why a free press matters, the nation reborn in 1948 is still very young. There's a typo in my column, huh? But is very much a nation of warriors, however rancorous in its internal politics. It has not lost sight of its purpose. In his introduction to a book of essays, The City and Man, the most significant political theorist of the last century, Leo Strauss, wrote this, quote, however much the power of the West may have declined, however great the dangers to the West may be, that decline, that danger, nay, that defeat, even the destruction of the West would not necessarily prove that the West is in a crisis. The West could go down in honor, certain of its purpose. The crisis of the West consists in the West having become uncertain of its purpose. Israel is not uncertain of its purpose. America, or at least its present executive branch, quite obviously is. If there are any other nominees for the job of leading the West, by all means nominate them, or work to restore America to its former position. Until that happens, every citizen of the West, looking for a nation committed to the freedom of its citizens and willing to defend that freedom at the cost of extraordinary loss of treasure, of life and treasure, will need to study the example of Israel and be willing and able to develop the weapons it will need to deter the enemies of freedom who have quite openly organized against the West. That can be found at the Hugh Hewitt Fox News page, and I encourage all of you to go there. I also encourage all of you, if you want to communicate with me, sometimes I read Twitter during the show, X, and someone said upon my reporting of the Biden suspension of JDAMs, didn't another president get impeached for suspending military aid to an ally for political reasons? And the answer is yes, they did. Joe Biden is indifferent to that because he knows there's two standards here. And my subtexters, if you belong to the universe, I read my subtext every morning. Can't respond to all of you. Sometimes I send out a group subtext. Some of you are annoyed by the group subtext, but occasionally I send it anyway. And thousands of you directly communicate, and I read all subtext. I try and read the Hugh at HughHewitt.com emails as well. And you can call the show whenever I take calls. Unlike most morning talk shows, I'm not here to talk to you, really. I'm here to give you the news. But my phone number is 1-800-520-1234. And I may take some calls later because I've got a lot of guests today. David Drucker's coming up, then Byron York, Admiral Stavridis, Brett Baer, Senator Tom Cotton, who's on many of the short lists. I did not have dinner with Senator Tom Cotton last night when I said I had dinner with two future cabinet members in Trump 2.0, maybe one of whom will be the vice president. I don't know. What communications I have with the former president at length, they're always on the air. I am not one of those people who ask you to trust me about what X, Y, or Z said. I don't quote my sources if I can't quote my sources. I just tell you, I got sources. And I know that there are a lot of names being bandied about. The list is very long. And my list is begins with Doug Burgum in alphabetical order. Doug Burgum, governor of North Dakota, very smart guy. Senator Tom Cotton, senator of Arkansas, very smart guy. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa, very smart woman. Former Secretary of State and CIA Director and Congressman Mike Pompeo, as smart as any of them. And then finally, Governor Glenn Youngkin of Virginia, because he's as smart as any of them. Did you notice I put smart, smart, smart? I should also say they're all ready to be president. Burgum, Cotton, Ernst, Pompeo, Youngkin, they could handle the job on day one if anything happened to Trump. Nothing's going to happen to Trump. He's like Godzilla. Really. You know, they zap him with electricity and he gets stronger. And Judge Merchan, if you're listening, you are a disgrace and an embarrassment to the rule of law in America. Your gag order is unconstitutional. Your indictment does not even name the crime. The indictment that you allowed to proceed. And now you're not allowing a key expert witness to come in and testify that Alvin Bragg's theory of the case is absurd and rejected by the Federal Election Commission. Bradley Smith is the expert witness. You're a disgrace, Judge Merchan, and everybody knows it who does not have TDS. You've got TDS. Should never have taken this case, having contributed to Joe Biden and to anti-Republican, even symbolic contributions. They were small. Symbolic contributions to telegraph to everyone. You're a Democrat, Democrat. You're a partisan, and you are a bad judge. Really bad judge. Welcome back, America. Apparently, Joe Biden wants Israel to share the land with Hamas. We're going to talk about that with Senator Tom Cotton, who joins me now, the senator from Arkansas. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm well. I hope you're well. I hope all your listeners are well, too. It's good to be back on with you.
We got a couple of new affiliates in Illinois, and so they haven't heard you before. I will just tell them you've been doing this at the House and the Senate for a long time, and you never make a mistake on air, so they can't listen for a faceplant. But you do faceplant on sports a lot because you spent 7 years in Boston. Are you a Celtics fan as well as a Red Sox fan?
No, Hugh, I'm really not NBA or basketball fan anymore. I'd say back in my youth in the days of Michael Jordan and Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, it was by far my favorite sport. But over the last 20 to 25 years, it's just fallen out of favor.
Okay. Just so you're not on the wrong side of history tonight, the Cavs are going to take on the Celtics. Let's get to the Israeli.
I'm well aware of why you're asking.
Okay. Let's just ask now. It has been confirmed by the Wall Street Journal. I played a clip of you on Fox yesterday. It had not yet been confirmed. Confirmed by the Wall Street Journal, Times of Israel, the United States has delayed shipments of JDAMs, precision-guided munitions. It is inexplicable, because that means Israel will have to use less precise munitions with more casualties to civilians. What is the thinking of the president and his advisors?
Well, Hugh, I take it as confirmed at this point. Now, it's not just the Axios, but the Wall Street Journal reporting it, and the fact that John Kirby from the National Security Council refused to confirm or deny yesterday, again, I think means that we can take it as confirmed that the administration has delayed the delivery of thousands of precision-guided munitions. I disagree with you that it's inexplicable. Inexplicable means that it can't be explained. It can easily be explained. Joe Biden, from the very beginning of this war, has put more pressure on Israel than he has put on Hamas or some of Hamas's patrons. in the region. And that's almost entirely because of the left wing and indeed the increasingly anti-Semitic wing of his party. And you see it time and again. You see it in the failure to deliver these weapons in a timely fashion, to publicly demanding that Israel not conduct an absolutely necessary military operation in Rafah, you know, wasting our taxpayer dollars and putting our soldiers at risk to build this stupid floating pier so we can send more aid into Gaza, as if it's somehow America's responsibility or Israel's responsibility to send aid to the civilians in Gaza, as opposed to Hamas's responsibility to make sure that they get necessary provisions, and for that matter, that they're not killed by, while being used as human shields. Time and time again, at every turn, Joe Biden has put more pressure on Israel than Hamas. I think what I would say is it's counterproductive, as you suggested, or self-defeating, not just this particular decision, but his policy going back to October 8th, because if he had simply backed Israel to the hilt, made it clear that we were going to do so, Israel would have had the freedom of action to destroy Hamas more quickly, and the civilian suffering in Gaza would have ended sooner rather than later. By protracting this war, Joe Biden has only made things worse in Gaza.
Now, Senator, one time can be a mistake. Two times could mean incompetence. Three times a pattern. The Afghanistan collapse, the failure to give Ukraine what they needed when they needed so that they could exploit their initial surprise and advantage on their first offensive. And now this, the pattern of the Biden administration is never don't retreat and never play to win. Am I overstating it or is that true?
I mean, I think you're understating it, Hugh, because you only cite three instances. You could cite 3,000 instances of Joe Biden's 52 years in public life. Remember, Bob Gates, who worked with him up close in the first year and a half of the Obama administration, said that he's been wrong on nearly every major foreign policy and national security decision of the last 40 years. You can now make it 50 years because he wrote that 10 years ago. He opposed, for instance, the bin Laden raid that killed Osama bin Laden. He repeatedly opposed things like missile defense systems when Ronald Reagan wanted to invest in missile defenses that are now being used to protect our troops in Israel in the Middle East, thank goodness. He consistently sided with communist revolutionaries and insurgencies or communist dictators in the Third World throughout the Cold War. Joe Biden is almost always wrong. He has terrible instincts. His staff's instincts are worse. Their political incentives are even worse. Yet most bizarrely at all, he seems supremely confident in his own abilities.
What do you think former president and future president Donald Trump's policy will be on the Israel-Hamas war?
Well, first off, I've told President Trump that at times he is too modest when he talks about this war in Gaza or the war in Ukraine. He said it wouldn't have happened on his watch. I think it's important to remember that he doesn't have to use the conditional. He can say it didn't happen on my watch and it will not happen again on my watch, because Vladimir Putin, to put it very bluntly, was scared of what Donald Trump would do if he invaded Ukraine again. He invaded when Barack Obama was president. He invaded when Joe Biden was president. He didn't do it when Donald Trump was president, in part because Donald Trump is the one that started arming the Ukrainians. Likewise, Iran did not unleash this region-wide attacks of terror against Israel and from Gaza, missile attacks from the Houthis into the Red Sea and now out into the Indian Ocean, pretty steady attacks from Hezbollah and Lebanon into Israel. These things did not happen under Donald Trump. With Donald Trump, we had peace and stability because he was a strong president and we were viewed as a strong nation. So when he is president, I am confident that Israel will have full American backing to do what's necessary to defend its people.
Senator Cotton, I like to tell my Democratic friends that the most important difference between the former and future President Trump and current President Biden is that President Trump is not afraid of anything, and Joe Biden is afraid of everything, including our enemies abroad and his left wing at home. Fair?
I do think that's fair. You know, when it comes to Vladimir Putin or Iran or Hamas, he's like an elephant who has seen a mouse and jumped up on a table, ironically, since an elephant obviously is, you know, 1,000 times the size of a mouse. And all it takes is the slightest threat of escalation for Joe Biden to either stand down himself, as he's forced our sailors who are sitting ducks in the Red Sea to these missile and drone attacks do, or to pressure our friends in places like Israel and Ukraine to stand down.
Now, Senator, I want to close with this today because I got to take a couple of calls here. But I saw your Jonathan Karl interview. I played a lot of it. I believe Jonathan was the least interested in your answers I've ever seen an anchor. When I ask a question, I let the interviewee answer it. I'll have to cut them off sometimes if they go a minute and a half. Was that unique in your experience among left-leaning journalists? And John is a man of the left. I mean, the mask is off. But he never let you answer a question.
Oh, Hugh, I'm not sure it's unique. That's one reason why, the three main networks and MSNBC and CNN's ratings have declined and certainly declined among Republicans because they don't seem to be that interested in the other point of view. I do believe, Hugh, that the media is desperate not to cover these little Gazas, these disgusting cesspools of anti-Semitic hatred that have sprung up on campuses around the country, because they realize how toxic that is for their side, for the Democrats. And they want to do anything to stop covering it. So John asked me a question or two about it that was in the news last week, and I was in the news talking about that and taking action on it. But then he said he wanted to move on to 2024. And my point to him was, we've been talking about 2024. These little Gazas on campus are a central issue in 2024 because they partly encapsulate the differences between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Joe Biden will not take action, for instance, to stop these protesters who have set up this disgusting rat-infested little Gaza on George Washington, where they are defacing statues of President Washington with terrorist headdresses and spray paint. Donald Trump, like, say, those frat boys at UNC, will take the steps that are necessary to defend the American flag, to restore law and order, to exhibit strength at home, just like he will abroad, to make sure that law-abiding Americans, in this case, students who just want to study for final exams, to say nothing of Jewish students who have been assaulted and harassed, can go about their business.
So, Senator, my last question. The two new affiliates are WZOEAM 1490 in the Illinois Valley and WLMD FM 104.7 in Western Illinois. They're about 100 to 120 miles away from Chicago. That's as close as I want to be to Chicago during the Democratic convention. I think it's going to be a replay of 68 and a nightmare, particularly given the governance of that city. What do you think?
Well, it certainly could be, Hugh. I mean, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris can't go out in public. For that matter, they really can't go out in private to their, Tony fundraisers without these pro-Hamas sympathizers shouting them down. Now, one difference between 2024 and 1968 is now the federal government is in charge of security, which is, say, Joe Biden's administration. So I would suspect that Joe Biden's administration is going to take draconian steps to ensure that these people don't get within a country mile of the convention site, unlike in 1968 when it was the Chicago city government that was responsible for it. But, I'm not sure they're going to be very helpful either. You may have seen the news that the Chicago mayor will not allow the Chicago PD to go into the University of Chicago campus to clear out their little Gaza. So I think the protesters are certainly going to try these tactics in Chicago. But I would suspect that Joe Biden's administration is going to use very aggressive tactics to keep them away from the convention. Something, for instance, that yet again they accuse their political opponents of doing, yet they're the ones who actually do it.
Senator Tom Cotton, thank you for your time this morning. Always very generous, and I appreciate it. And do not fall back into your Celtic ways. Just stay with the Cavs tonight, Senator. Stay with the Cavs. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. My guest is Brett Baer, anchor of Special Report, which you watch every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. on the Fox News Channel. Good morning, Brett. After Thursday's show, I heard from all my Democratic friends. And that tells me that Democrats are watching Special Report as much as Republicans. You must be very happy. I've never asked you about your demographics or your audience, but I'm glad it's crossing over from the traditional Fox News audience to everybody.
Thanks, Hugh. One viewer at a time.
One viewer.
I'm good. We do have a prompt section.
Would you tell people about your son to the extent you're comfortable? Because I'm just so impressed with his resilience.
Sure. Paul is 16 years old, and he's been through a lot. He had, prior to this, four open-heart surgeries and 10 angioplasties. And you know, we thought we were done. And he had a virus. He went into the doctor. She took a chest x-ray by chance, and not a normal thing. They found a shadow on his lung. Amy, my wife, sent it to the cardiologist, and the cardiologist said it's probably no big deal, but let's get an MRI. He flew into D.C. We got an MRI, and it was a golf ball-sized aneurysm off his heart. And if we didn't operate quickly, it could burst, and it would be fatal. And so that was his fifth open-heart surgery just 8 days ago. And he is fantastic. He's 6'4". He has bounced back, and we're blessed.
You know, I told you that when I was talking to you about it last week. I think this is an inspiration for every family who's gone through a medical process that will last years. And Paul's resilience is an incredible inspiration to people. And I just, the one thing I can't get over, I've talked about it with Betsy again and again and again, is that they texted you from the surgery room. I don't know that I want to get those texts, Brett Baer.
They did. They said, we're on bypass, we're off bypass, he's doing well. We're getting updates throughout. The most amazing thing, Hugh, really quickly, is that, you know, they told me, they sat me down after the MRI, and I was devastated, and I called Amy, and she was devastated and crying and the whole thing. And I went down, and I told Paul, and I said, listen, buddy, this is tough. You know, it's just not, it's not good, and we got to have open heart surgery. And he said, you're kidding me. And I said, no, I'm serious. And, you know, a tear went down his eye, and he gulped. And then he looked at me, and he said, all right, Dad, let's do this thing. And that, for me, is just really empowering. I go through a lot of stuff. I have a lot of stupid stuff that I deal with. And that's big stuff, and he gets through it.
That is big stuff. That's what I mean. It just is such a gift of proportionality to my listeners to understand that they may have problems and they're serious, but you can get through them, and a 15-year-old is showing the way, as is mom, dad, and family. By the way, is he a golfer?
He is. He's on the golf team down in Oxbridge Academy. So he's a 2-handicap, Hugh.
Oh!
And he hits it past me.
Oh, that's humbling. That's so humbling. Well, I hope he's back out. Have you won a father-son tournament anywhere yet?
Yeah, we won a father-son at Burning Tree. And so he's got 6 weeks, and he can swing the club again. So we were told that, and Paul asked, how long will I have? And he said 6 weeks, the surgeon did. So I took him out to Burning Tree that Wednesday after we got the MRI. And we played 10 holes, and he beat me by one on the
11th
hole. He chipped in, and I was trying hard.
That's fabulous. I remember every father-son. I'm the third of three boys, so I only got two of them. But it was all. It's the most memorable thing to play in competition with your dad. So good luck. I hope you win. And that's I just hope you win. I don't care about who else is on the tee. Okay, Brett, let's get to the news. I'm very impressed with that. God bless him. Tell me about the great mentioner. I had dinner last night with a couple of people who are on many of the lists for VP, and they're all very humble, and they deny it, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm going to talk to Cotton coming up, and he's on every list. What do you hear, Brett Baer, about – you talk actually to the former president as much as anybody. What do you hear?
You know, he's very tight-lipped, actually, when it comes to VP. And you know, you can talk to him ad nauseum, and he's not going to give you anything. I think this is probably going to be a process. You know, I mean, it's essentially The Apprentice on steroids. So I do hear that Marco Rubio is has been mentioned a lot. I do hear that that Doug Burgum has gone up in the you know, mentioners thing. I don't think that diversity and whether there's a woman on the ticket is really in the president's mindset. I think he thinks who's the best person to be in that spot. So
to be president right away and to never make a mistake that cripples his campaign. I that's what I've talked with him about. And I don't think minority or female status. It might be that Joni Ernst is on my short list, which is Burgum, Cotton, Ernst, Pompeo, and Youngkin. But none of those ever make a mistake. That's the key to me. Is don't, you know, the media environment. Don't make a mistake. Second question. I don't know if this will lead tonight. The suspension of joint JDAMs, precision guided munitions, is astonishing to me. It's astonishing. Admiral Stavridis is just on. Because it means Israel will have to use bombs that are less discriminating, and they're not going to stop their offensive. What do you make of that, Brett Baer?
Well, I just think it's a real political decision that, you know, has implications. And I think, you know, we think about it in implications domestically. But there's implications, you know, around the world. You know, what message that sends to other allies. And I don't think it's the end of what we're going to hear about this decision and whether it's good or bad.
You know, you have General Jack on a lot. I don't know if he's on today. He's really among the very best people out there. Have you discussed this with him yet?
I mean, I touched on it last time. We don't have him on today. We have Senator Fetterman on today.
Oh, good. Oh,
and he'll be on set, and we're talking about a whole host of issues, and this will be among them. But yeah, General Keane is really plugged in, and you know, we have him as a senior military advisor, but he's more than that. I mean, he's really in the heart of intelligence and military, and so when you hear what he says on our channel, that comes with a lot of real knowledge behind it, not just from past, but from current.
You know, between the general and Secretary Pompeo, you really have all you need in terms of strategic and sometimes tactical advice. Let me close by talking a little bit about Senator Fetterman. Mary Catherine Hamm and Vic Mattis run the Getting Hammered podcast, and they have a segment called You Love to Hear It, and they should just rename it the Fetterman segment, because they always are playing a little Fetterman tape. Last week, he said there are two kinds of demonstrators, pro-Hamas and really pro-Hamas right now. He'll, you know, has he ever been your guest on set before?
He has not. And I don't know what we're going to get. I mean, we may have Senator Fetterman with a hoodie. I'm not sure he's going to be on set. But we welcome him. And not just because he's bucked the trend about what he said and done about his party, but because he's really an interesting character. If you think about the trajectory of his politics, beating Dr. Oz, and then, you know, it really becoming somebody that you don't know where his vote is.
Yeah, well, he is still a Steelers fan, so never trust him on the NFL. Go Browns. Brett Baer, thank you for joining me. Congratulations to Paul and to you and to Amy and to everyone in the Baer extended family, and good luck tonight with John Fetterman. I'm sure it'll be newsworthy. We'll be watching Special
Thank
Report
you.
Tonight at 6 p.m. on the Fox News channel. Welcome back, America, to my new audiences, my new affiliates. WZOEAM 1490 in the Illinois Valley. WLMDFM 104.7 in Western Illinois. That music means Admiral James Stavridis is in the house, retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO, former head of Southern Command, now chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, and I think he is the vice chair of the Carlyle Group. Good morning, Admiral. Good morning, Admiral. Did we put you on mute?
Nope, I'm right here.
Okay, there you are. Admiral, good morning. You're traveling.
So I'm out in Los Angeles, so I'm up at 4:30 in the morning to do this. Nobody loves you do it more than I do.
Thank you to whomever that is. Admiral, I can't hear you very well, so that's probably on my end. So I'm going to let you hold forth on what it means for the United States to suspend the shipment of JDAMs. You got to explain what they are, why they are important, and what it will do to the Israeli offensive in Rafah. please.
A Joint Direct Action Munition, JDAM is the acronym. It's a very accurate form of air-dropped weapon that can be used with extreme precision. So it is the weapon that Israel will need if it's going to do what it has set out to do, which is to conduct using their spokesman's word, a precision counterterrorism operation. So if they don't have the JDAMs to conduct that operation, they will use other weapons that will cause higher levels of collateral damage. So a JDAM is the weapon that Israel needs to conduct this operation in as safe a manner as it can be conducted.
Now, you tend to avoid criticism of both Republicans and Democrats, but I, for the life of me, can't understand this, because I knew what a JDAM was, and I think Israel will have to turn to less precise munitions, artillery shells or dumber bombs. And I'm curious, why in the world would an administration take away that which limits civilian casualties the most?
I don't have a ready answer for that. I would be guessing. I will tell you this. We need to continue to support Israel. And frankly, it's not just with precision-guided JDAMs. We have to support them with cyber, with intelligence, with the mechanisms they need to decommission this complex of tunnels that are beneath Gaza, which include high-end engineering, precisely available explosives. All of that needs to be part of a package of support to Israel. And I continue to believe that supporting Israel in this conflict with a terrorist organization, I mean, let's step back here. This is a terrorist group that has raped and mutilated and killed, is using their own people as human shields. We ought to be giving Israel full support in this moment.
Now, Admiral, I want to turn to a different subject, which has to do with conducting diplomacy. You've done a lot of that, and I want people to understand, as Allied Supreme Commander of NATO, he had to do a lot of it. Apparently, according to Axios this morning, the United States and Egypt negotiated a deal with Hamas that Israel rejected, and they didn't get Israel's input before they announced that a deal was there. That's unprecedented in my view. Is it unprecedented in your view?
It is. And I was not only the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, but I spent 5 years as the Dean of the, wait for it, Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. It's a school of diplomacy. And I'm hard-pressed to recall another instance in a significant war-fighting negotiation where one party decides to change the terms and then announce that we have a deal. Let's be very clear here. The deal that Hamas has come back with is completely unacceptable. It fails in both space and time. What I mean by that is the space is the Hamas says Israel has to simply leave Gaza. That's impossible. And then secondly, the Hamas version says that this is the end of the war, the time element here, that the war is concluded. The point being that if those two things occurred, this reprehensible leader of Hamas, Sinwar, would emerge from the tunnels, blinking at the lights of the sun above him, and announce that Hamas won the war. That's impossible for Israel to accept. The way this concluding part of the negotiation unfolded, diplomatically unacceptable.
Now, Admiral, I want to turn to the Rockefeller Foundation, and I don't want to put you on the spot, so I'll tell you the whole story and then just see if you want to comment or not. You probably don't know anything about this. There are allegations that the Rockefeller Fund, which is not the Rockefeller Foundation until
correct,
someone tells me that it is, has been funding an organization that is in turn supporting campus protests that are blatantly anti-Semitic. Any idea what that is? Is that on your radar at all?
It is not, other than a number of friends have sent exactly what you just said to me, and I will reply in the way I did and will continue to do, which is John D. Rockefeller, the richest man in the world over 100 years ago, endowed a host of different things around the country to which he put his name, one of which is the Rockefeller Fund. We have nothing to do with it.
Ah.
It would be like if the name was Smith. I mean, it's a very common name. The Rockefeller Fund has its own source of funding, its own uses. I know nothing about the Rockefeller Fund. There's also, for example, a Rockefeller University. We have nothing to do with Rockefeller University. There are buildings all around the country and libraries that are named after Rockefeller. We have nothing to do with
that. There's a Rockefeller rest stop on the 90. You got nothing to do with that either?
Nope, nothing to do with that one either, Hugh.
Admiral, okay, so I got to now switch one more time. Sure. Congressman Michael Waltz, who's on Armed Services, Foreign Affairs, and Intel, has replaced the now retired Mike Gallagher as my David Dreyer Honorary House Member of the Week. He tells me there's a naval strategy coming out of Congress this week. What does that matter to the Navy? Do they even care? Does anyone read these things?
I think people read them, and having worked a strategy in the Pentagon for many, many years, like our mutual friend Jerry Hendricks, you know, it's all input and people have ideas and they're thoughtful sometimes and it goes grist into the mill. I doubt a congressional naval strategy will be at the center of the Navy's thinking, but I'll make a point here. Many in Congress, and I would count Mike Waltz, who, as you know, is a Green Beret, Special Forces, Colonel, I believe, in the reserves, well thought of on the defense side of things. I'm sure that naval strategy, if his fingerprints are on it, will talk about the need for a fleet that is of significant size to stand up to China. And I, for one, will read the strategy. If it's good and it talks about increasing the size of the U.S. Navy, I bet it will. I will get behind it and talk about it and recommend it to the Navy staff, the Joint Chiefs, and the Pentagon.
Last question, Admiral. I want to give you 2 or 3 minutes to expound on this. Joe Lonsdale, venture capitalist and co-founder of Palantir, was on the show last week. Not to talk about Palantir, but about a couple of his other startups, which have ambition to become a so-called prime and to deliver submersibles to the Navy. What do you, because they think the future is submersibles and Joe gets stuff done. What are the odds of that actually happening, do you think?
I think they are pretty good for 2 reasons. One is spot on that the future of naval warfare is under the sea. The real predators of the ocean, apex predators, are nuclear attack submarines. These have very small crews, 100-ish or so. They can remain submerged indefinitely, limited only by food for the crew, and they have lethal torpedo systems that can sink surface ships. They're quite remarkable, and you can attack them from the air, you can attack them from destroyers, but boy, I wouldn't like those odds, being a destroyer captain again, going up against a nuclear attack submarine. So point one, he's on to a real demand signal. And point two, frankly, where he will head, no doubt, is unmanned or very small crews, and that, I think, is also the future of warfare generally, but it also reduces cost. It can be done much more quickly. A Palantir-like set of solutions applied to these big, complex challenges, I think, is very attractive. Final thought, it's like what we're watching in Ukraine, where we're seeing drones, smaller, quicker, lighter, yet more lethal, knitted together by artificial intelligence. Think that kind of drone swarm applied to the ocean, below the ocean. That's a pretty powerful thought. I wouldn't bet against him.
All right, okay, bonus question, Admiral. His other company doing directed energy research and weaponry, and I chatted last night with someone about, they're basically lasers. Do you think we're close on that?
I do, and I've been following this issue for a decade, and think about it this way. The way we knock down incoming missiles today, and think of them as like a telephone pole flying through the air, we launch another telephone pole that goes up into the air and seeks to find that precise point and knock it down. Unbelievably, we are pretty good at doing that. But the problem is you run out of telephone poles pretty quickly. With directed energy lasers, you have an unlimited supply. So so you can shoot again and again and again, and your odds of knocking down those incoming telephone poles are extremely high. And yes, we're getting closer and closer. Both Air Force is very involved, Navy very involved. These will be on ships. The Iron Dome system has a guided laser system coming right behind it. I think, not to make a bad pun here, but the future is bright for those lasers.
Oh, Admiral, that is pretty bad. I'm going to leave it there. I want my audience, my new audiences to understand Admiral Stav is not a fan of puns, but he couldn't resist that one. Admiral James Stavridis, safe travel. Thank you for being up really early in the morning in L.A., and hello to all my friends out there. Thank you, Admiral. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway, welcoming our two new affiliates in Illinois. And they're fabulous because they're 100 miles from Chicago. WZOE AM 1490 in the Illinois Valley. WLMD FM 104.7 in Western Illinois. That takes us over 470 affiliates and other platforms, and I'm glad to have you aboard. Byron York of the Washington Examiner and the Fox News contributor, familiar to many of you, joins me as he does most Tuesdays. Good morning, Byron.
Good morning, Hugh.
The Illinois Valley is about as close as I'm going to come to Chicago when the Democrats convene in August. What do you expect the city to be like?
Well, you know, I've been kind of going back and forth about being there. And I will say the possibility of unrest is probably the most interesting thing about the upcoming convention, because, I mean, it seems kind of karmic that it's in Chicago, and Chicago, of course, was the site in 1968 of the most famous convention protests ever. So I think there's a pretty good chance, although I will say security at the conventions has just changed completely. If you go, you know, conventions today, even without threats of big protests, are just these enormous walled camps where they put up a 10-foot wall all around the convention zone, very hard to get in. So most of the stuff will be taking place outside the wall, probably.
You know, in 2000 in L.A., they had it very well done, and the protesters cooperated. In 2004 at Madison Square Garden, the New York PD built a long tunnel of fences that ran from 32nd Street all the way up to like 44th, and the demonstrators pounded on it. It was kind of a weird thing. Dwayne and I were there. 2012 was a nightmare. I was staying at St. Pete's Beach driving into Tampa Bay, and it took forever because all the bridges were up. They were afraid of terrorists. I'm just done because nobody's in the hall anyway from 6 to 9 in the morning, so I'm just done going to conventions. Byron, I had dinner last night with two people who could either be cabinet secretaries or vice presidents, and we were talking about the Hewitt option. Both of them dismissed it, but I believe Joe Biden's going to throw in the towel at the convention and throw it up to the convention because he's just incapacitated, Byron. The remarks at the Cinco de Mayo yesterday were deeply embarrassing, and I fear for the country. What are the odds of the Hewitt option? Because they don't want Kamala Harris. Nobody wants Kamala Harris. So you just go to the convention and say, I'm sorry, I can't do this. I'm turning it over to the delegates.
Well, I'm afraid it's an extremely dramatic scenario. It's a made-in-Hollywood scenario. But I'm afraid I think the odds of the Hewitt option are zero. Because even if the president did come to the realization that he's not up to a second term, which everybody else in the country already knows, he wouldn't roll it out in that way. But it is very dramatic. And, just like every other event, the convention will be designed by the Biden campaign to try to conceal as best they can the president's infirmities, but it won't be fully possible.
Well, in this conversation last night, someone said we know Kamala Harris would fight for it, and it would be an embarrassment to the party if their first African-American senior ticket member did not get elevated automatically. But she's a loser, and everyone knows it. And one of our staffers around the table suggested that's why they want to move Sotomayor off the court to put Kamala Harris on it. I thought, oh, that's one way out of that dilemma. But Sotomayor ain't going anywhere. She's fine.
You know, I've thought the whole Sotomayor thing is an expression of lack of confidence in Joe Biden, and also in Democrats holding the Senate, because it's often remarked that Republicans have one of their best Senate maps you can get coming up. So either one of those things happens, Joe Biden does not win the White House, or maybe he does win the White House and Democrats don't win the Senate, and there could be problems on the Supreme Court. On the other hand, Justice Sotomayor is I think, turning 70 this year, and clearly by many Supreme Court standards has a number of productive years ahead of her. And I think that this talk about her, you know, retiring is one, you know, they were scarred by the whole experience of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who did stay on long past when she should have retired. And two, they're afraid that, you know, come this time next year, there's either not going to be a Democratic president, or there's not going to be a Democratic Senate, or there's not going to be either one.
But, you know, Byron, Justice Breyer retired last year, two years ago. He gave a great interview this week. He's still fine, fit and fiddle. I think he's bored. And I just can't imagine going out at 70. It's sort of, it's just not 75, 78 maybe, but not 70. I would expect Justice Thomas to retire in the next term if Donald Trump is back in the White House. But let me ask you about vice president, since the great mentioner has been hard at work. And the list has grown very long. Everyone on the radio knows my list is short. It's Doug Burgum, Tom Cotton, alphabetical order. Doug Burgum, Tom Cotton, Joni Ernst, Mike Pompeo, Glenn Youngkin. What do and to my new audiences, Byron York is the best source reporter in Washington on what Republicans are doing. Who's on the list? Who's serious? And what do you think, Byron?
You know, I think Burgum and Youngkin are pretty serious on that list. I will say I wrote an article last month, went down to Mar-a-Lago and talked to Trump. And so the ground rules is it's all on the record. You know, so there was only one time when he asked to go off the record, and it was I had asked him about the vice presidency. And he said, well, let's go off the record. And I did, and then he didn't tell me anything. Absolutely nothing.
I've asked him many times, and I've actually told him, this is not a secret, I won't tell you what he told me. I've told him, I don't think it makes a lick of difference if you have a person of color or a woman on the ticket. Go for someone who can attack, and can be president on short notice. That's it. That's all that matters to me.
You know, I think with Trump, an important thing is kind of a temperament contrast. You know, so when Barack Obama has just newly arrived in the U.S. Senate. Before that, he's been an Illinois state senator and a community organizer. And people are, you know, worried about his experience to be president of the United States. Well, he hires Joe Biden to be his vice president. And Joe Biden has been in the Senate for a million years, even at that time, and is Mr. Experience to sort of balance that ticket in an experience sort of way. With Trump, I think, he might be looking for a temperament balance so that people say, well, you know, Trump is he is what he is. He absolutely is what he is, kind of a real firecracker. And we've got this steady guy as his vice president, and the ticket sort of feels balanced. I think Mike Pence gave him that sort of balance in 2016. So anyway,
everyone on my list, Burgum, Cotton, Pompeo, Youngkin, and Ernst does the same thing.
Yeah, and I just think that Burgum and Youngkin, also as governors, Republicans still do like governors, are both good choices.
But I do think the Sunday shows we had Cotton, Rubio, Scott, and Burgum on the four big Sunday shows. They all did well. The best was Cotton, who is just an absolute Harvard lawyer when he gets on these things. How much does that matter to Trump? The compatibility, trustworthy, experience, contrast, well, yes. But how about being on the shows?
You know, Cotton is an interesting choice among these people. I think he was first elected in 2014. So he's reelected in 20. So he's up in 26. He's totally safe to run now. And I do think one of the things Cotton considers is Trump had wanted him, I think, to work for his administration earlier. And, you know, you don't just give up a Senate seat for a job in an administration where a lot of people don't seem to last very long. So I don't see Cotton taking a job as a cabinet secretary. I see him probably staying in the Senate. As far as vice president is concerned, of course, you can go run for vice president, and if you don't win, you can go back and resume your Senate job. So I think that's a real possibility.
I think AG is the cabinet slot for him, if not, because no nonsense. Just like sort of Bill Barr, but at 39, Nixon to Eisenhower, Nixon in 52.
Bill Barr the first time around.
Yeah. Bill Barr the first time around. Now, and Bill Barr the second time around until post-election. Smartest guy in the administration tied with Pompeo. Thank you, Byron York.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back, America. David M. Drucker is the chief political analyst for The Dispatch. Good morning, David. How are you? Our music froze, so we didn't get our music key.
That's all right, Hugh. I'm good. Thank you.
David, did you go to the White House Cinco de Mayo celebration yesterday?
I did not.
Okay, so I asked that because I wasn't there either. I wasn't invited, but you don't look Latino, and I'm not Latino. But the president, you speak Biden. I've lost my ability to speak Biden, so I'd like you to translate three clips from this. This is cut number 20 from yesterday.
Look, we have your backs. You've had ours. In March in Nevada, I invited the most ambitious housing plan for decades to come into being. For example, it boosts construction and rental units and lowers rent. It cracked down on discrimination by home appraisers, so Latino homes are finally valued as fairly as they were when built by wealthy families. Folks,
all right, David Drucker, you're a pretty serious student of housing. What's that mean?
Well, look, I haven't looked into this topic, Hugh, recently, but it sounds like he's talking about housing affordability and the notion that homes owned by Latino families in Nevada and elsewhere aren't appraised as high as those owned by white families. And look, I don't know the facts behind this, but I know we've heard this before, usually about African-American neighborhoods where it's harder to get loans and homes aren't as praised as much as their neighbors that are owned by.
Redlining. Was actually talking about redlining for Latinos. I've never read of that anywhere. And I've never read that the wealthier the family, the higher the appraisal. And I've been in the land use lawyering business for 30 years, though I'm retired. Let's try cut 21.
There's always have been compelling value sets to Visions of America. One of those value sets is revenge and retribution.
So for those who didn't hear it, there have always been compelling vision sets, the visions of America. One of those value sets is revenge and retribution. What do you think he was trying to say, David?
I think he was trying to say that Trump's value set is revenge and retribution.
Yeah, I think he had teleprompter said competing visions, and he read compelling visions. That's what I think happened. You think that's a good explanation?
Yeah, that's a good explanation.
Yeah. Last one, cut 22.
He wants to cut Social Security and Medicare. He says there's a lot we can do in terms of cutting. I got one really serious idea how to cut. Kennedy. Anyway.
He lost the thread. David, my overarching theme, he's been infirm for a while. He's lurched into incoherence in the last couple of months. I think he's on his way to incapacity. Do you see that?
I don't see that, but more, you know, I think forget what I see or don't see. I mean, look, the people that I've talked to in Democratic circles are aware of his age. It concerns them. They're more concerned about how he presents physically and how he presents when he gives remarks, more so than this idea that his mental capacity isn't functioning the way it needs to. And so that's just, you know, what I will tell you about Democrats is that, you know, they're not living in a fantasy world. They realize that this is an issue, and but they realize there's nothing they can do about it. And so, you know, if they had their way, he would present a lot better. But there's just no way around this. So he's got to lean into it and, you know, be out there and hope it works. And that's, you know, kind of the predicament that they're in. But, you know, for a lot of them, even though Biden doesn't appear as sharp or present as sharp, they say one-on-one and within meetings, he's still sharp and still doing his job. It's just that, you know, from their point of view, they have a political challenge, and that is very apparent because there are a lot of clips like this, and there are going to continue to be a lot of clips like this. It's just that there's no escape from it, because if he tries to hide from it by not being out there, not talking, that only exacerbates the problem. So you lean in, and, you know, from their perspective, you hope for the best.
Now, he's going to give a speech on anti-Semitism. I think it's today at the Holocaust Memorial. I think it's fraught for him because
the U.S. Capitol.
U.S.
Capitol.
Oh, it's at the U.S. Capitol?
It's at the U.S. Capitol.
Okay.
Yes.
They've changed it. I did not know that. Do you have hopes that he will do better than he has at every other speech for months?
Well, I think, if you look at, you know, there was Biden immediately after October 7th, and then there's been, and then it's been a sort of hodgepodge, and it's been back and forth between which constituency he was trying to satisfy. If you look at the proclamation he put out, the White House proclamation he put out the other day on Holocaust remembrance, it was reminiscent of how he was talking about these issues right after October 7th. And so if he gives a speech that reflects the proclamation, and if he gives a speech that reflects the information the White House put out this morning about its efforts to combat anti-Semitism in the administration, then I think a lot of people are going to be happy with it. But we'll see.
We will see. David M. Drucker, follow him on an X. I got a couple of new affiliates in Illinois, David, so I want them to follow my regular guest, David M. Drucker of the Dispatch.